How does a picture from the outer solar system get to us? Sunlight shines on Europa in its orbit around Jupiter and is reflected back to space, where some of it strikes the phosphors of the Voyager television cameras, generating an image. The image is read by the Voyager computers, radioed back across the immense intervening distance of 500 million kilometers to a radio telescope, a ground station on the Earth. There is one in Spain, one in the Mojave Desert of Southern California, and one in Australia. On that July morning in 1979, it was the one in Australia that was pointed toward Jupiter and Europa. It then passes the information via a communications satellite in Earth orbit to Southern California, where it is transmitted by a set of microwave relay towers to a computer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where it is processed. The picture is fundamentally like a newspaper wire photo, made of perhaps a million individual dots, each a different shade of gray, so fine and close together that at a distance, the constituent dots are invisible. We see only their cumulative effect. The information from the spacecraft specifies how bright or dark each dot is to be. After processing, the dots are then stored on a magnetic disk, something like a phonograph record. There are some 18,000 photographs taken in the Jupiter system by Voyager 2 that are stored on such magnetic disks, and an equivalent number for Voyager 1. Finally, the end product of this remarkable set of links and relays is a thin piece of glossy paper, in this case, showing the wonders of Europa, recorded, processed, and examined for the first time in human history on July 9, 1979. What we saw on such pictures was absolutely astonishing. Voyager 1 obtained excellent imagery of the other three Galilean satellites of Jupiter, but not Europa. It was left for Voyager 2 to acquire the first close-up pictures of Europa, where we see things that are only a few kilometers across. At first glance, the place looks like nothing so much as the canal network that Percival Lowell imagined to adorn Mars, and that, we now know from space vehicle exploration, does not exist at all. We see, on Europa, an amazing intricate network of intersecting straight and curved lines. Are they ridges, that is, raised? Are they troughs, that is, depressed? How are they made? Are they part of a global tectonic system produced perhaps by fracturing of an expanding or contracting planet? Are they connected with plate tectonics on the Earth? What light do they shed on the other satellites of the Jovian system? At the moment of discovery, the vaunted technology has produced something astonishing. But it remains for another device, the human brain, to figure it out. Europa turns out to be as smooth as a billiard ball despite the network of lineations. The absence of impact craters may be due to the heating and flow of surface ice upon impact. The lines are grooves or cracks, their origin still being debated long after the mission. If the Voyager missions were manned, the captain would keep a ship's log, and the log, a combination of the events of Voyagers 1 and 2, might read something like this. Day 1. After much concern about provisions and instruments which seemed to be malfunctioning, we successfully lifted off from Cape Canaveral on our long journey to the planets and the stars. Day 2. A problem in the deployment of the boom that supports the science scan platform. If the problem is not solved, we will lose most of our pictures and other scientific data. Day 13. We have looked back and taken the first photograph ever obtained of the Earth and Moon as worlds together in space. A pretty pair. Day 150. Engines fired nominally for a mid-course trajectory correction. Day 170. Routine housekeeping functions. An uneventful few months. Day 185. Successful calibration images taken of Jupiter. Day 207. Boom problem solved, but failure of main radio transmitter. We have moved to backup transmitter. If it fails, no one on Earth will ever hear from us again. Day 215. We cross the orbit of Mars. That planet itself is on the other side of the sun. Day 295. We enter the asteroid belt. There are many large tumbling boulders here, the shoals and reefs of space. Most of them are uncharted, lookouts posted. We hope to avoid a collision. Day 475. We safely emerge from the main asteroid belt, happy to have survived. Day 570. Jupiter is becoming prominent in the sky. We can now make out finer detail on it than the largest telescopes on Earth have ever obtained. Day 615. The colossal weather systems and changing clouds of Jupiter spinning in space before us have us hypnotized. The planet is immense. It is more than twice as massive as all the other planets put together. There are no mountains, valleys, volcanoes, rivers, no boundaries between land and air, just a vast ocean of dense gas and floating clouds. A world without a surface. Everything we can see on Jupiter is floating in its sky. Day 630. The weather on Jupiter continues to be spectacular. This ponderous world spins on its axis in less than 10 hours. Its atmospheric motions are driven by the rapid rotation, by sunlight, and by the heat bubbling and welling up from its interior. Day 640. The cloud patterns are distinctive and gorgeous. They remind us a little of Van Gogh's Starry Night, or works by William Blake or Edvard Munch. But only a little. No artist ever painted like this because none of them ever left our planet. No painter trapped on Earth ever imagined a world so strange and lovely. We observe the multicolored belts and bands of Jupiter close up. The white bands are thought to be high clouds, probably ammonia crystals. The brownish-colored belts, deeper and hotter places where the atmosphere is sinking. The blue places are apparently deep holes in the overlying clouds through which we see clear sky. We do not know the reason for the reddish-brown color of Jupiter. Perhaps it is due to the chemistry of phosphorus or sulfur. Perhaps it is due to complex, brightly colored organic molecules produced when ultraviolet light from the sun breaks down the methane, ammonia, and water in the Jovian atmosphere, and the molecular fragments recombine. In that case, the colors of Jupiter speak to us of chemical events that 4 billion years ago, back on Earth, led to the origin of life. Day 647. The Great Red Spot. A great column of gas reaching high above the adjacent clouds, so large that it could hold half a dozen Earths. Perhaps it is red because it is carrying up to view the complex molecules produced or concentrated at greater depth. It may be a great storm system, 1 million years old. Day 650. Encounter, a day of wonders. We successfully negotiate the treacherous radiation belts of Jupiter with only one instrument, the photopolarimeter, damaged. We accomplish the ring plane crossing and suffer no collisions with the particles and boulders of the newly discovered rings of Jupiter. And wonderful images of Amalthea, a tiny red oblong world that lives in the heart of the radiation belt. Of multicolored Io, of the linear markings on Europa, the cobwebby features of Ganymede, the great multi-ringed basin on Callisto. We round Callisto and pass the orbit of Jupiter 13, the outermost of the planet's known moons. We are outward bound. Day 662. Our particle and field detectors indicate that we have left the Jovian radiation belts. The planet's gravity has boosted our speed. We are free of Jupiter at last and sail again the sea of space. Day 874. A loss of the ship's lock on the star Canopus, in the lore of constellations the rudder of a sailing vessel. It is our rudder, too, essential for the ship's orientation in the dark of space to find our way through this unexplored part of the cosmic ocean. Canopus lock reacquired. The optical sensors seem to have mistaken Alpha and Beta Centauri for Canopus. Next port of call, 2 years hence, the Saturn system. Of all the travelers' tales returned by Voyager, my favorites concern the discoveries made on the innermost Galilean satellite, Io. Before Voyager, we were aware of something strange about Io. We could resolve few features on its surface, but we knew it was red. Extremely red. Redder than Mars, perhaps the reddest object in the solar system. Over a period of years, something seemed to be changing on it. In infrared light, and perhaps in its radar reflection properties. We also know that partially surrounding Jupiter in the orbital position of Io was a great donut-shaped tube of atoms, sulfur and sodium and potassium, material somehow lost from Io. When Voyager approached this giant moon, we found a strange multicolored surface unlike any other in the solar system. Io is near the asteroid belt. It must have been thoroughly pummeled throughout its history by falling boulders. Impact craters must have been made, yet there were none to be seen. Accordingly, there had to be some process on Io that was extremely efficient in rubbing craters out or filling them in. The process could not be atmospheric since Io's atmosphere has mostly escaped to space because of its low gravity. It could not be running water. Io's surface is far too cold. There were a few places that resembled the summits of volcanoes, but it was hard to be sure. Linda Morabito, a member of the Voyager navigation team responsible for keeping Voyager precisely on its trajectory, was routinely ordering a computer to enhance an image of the edge of Io to bring out the stars behind it. To her astonishment, she saw a bright plume standing off in the darkness from the satellite's surface and soon determined that the plume was in exactly the position of one of the suspected volcanoes. Voyager had discovered the first active volcano beyond the Earth. We know now of 9 large volcanoes spewing out gas and debris and hundreds, perhaps thousands, of extinct volcanoes on Io. The debris, rolling and flowing down the sides of the volcanic mountains, arching in great jets over the polychrome landscape, is more than enough to cover the impact craters. We are looking at a fresh planetary landscape, a surface newly hatched. How Galileo and Huygens would have marveled. The volcanoes of Io were predicted before they were discovered by Stanton Peale and his co-workers, who calculated the tides that would be raised in the solid interior of Io by the combined pulls of the nearby moon Europa and the giant planet Jupiter. They found that the rocks inside Io should have been melted not by radioactivity, but by tides, that much of the interior of Io should be liquid. It now seems likely that the volcanoes of Io are tapping an underground ocean of liquid sulfur, melted and concentrated near the surface. When solid sulfur is heated a little past the normal boiling point of water, to about 115 degrees centigrade, it melts and changes color. The higher the temperature, the deeper the color. If the molten sulfur is quickly cooled, it retains its color. The pattern of colors that we see on Io resembles closely what we would expect if rivers and torrents and sheets of molten sulfur were pouring out of the mouths of the volcanoes. Black sulfur, the hottest, near the top of the volcano, red and orange, including the rivers nearby, and great plains covered by yellow sulfur at a greater remove. The surface of Io is changing on a time scale of months. Maps will have to be issued regularly, like weather reports on Earth. Those future explorers on Io will have to keep their wits about them. The very thin and tenuous atmosphere of Io was found by Voyager to be composed mainly of sulfur dioxide. But this thin atmosphere can serve a useful purpose, because it may be just thick enough to protect the surface from the intense charged particles in the Jupiter radiation belt in which Io is embedded. At night, the temperature drops so low that the sulfur dioxide should condense out as a kind of white frost. The charged particles would then immolate the surface, and it would probably be wise to spend the nights just slightly underground. The great volcanic plumes of Io reach so high that they are close to injecting their atoms directly into the space around Jupiter. The volcanoes are the probable source of the great donut-shaped ring of atoms that surrounds Jupiter in the position of Io's orbit. These atoms, gradually spiraling in toward Jupiter, should coat the inner moon Amalthea and may be responsible for its reddish coloration. It is even possible that the material outgassed from Io contributes, after many collisions and condensations, to the ring system of Jupiter. A substantial human presence on Jupiter itself is much more difficult to imagine, although I suppose great balloon cities permanently floating in its atmosphere are a technological possibility for the remote future. As seen from the near sides of Io, or Europa, that immense and variable world fills much of the sky, hanging aloft, never to rise or set, because almost every satellite in the solar system keeps a constant face to its planet, as the moon does to the Earth. Jupiter will be a source of continuing provocation and excitement for the future human explorers of the Jovian moons. As the solar system condensed out of interstellar gas and dust, Jupiter acquired most of the matter that was not ejected into interstellar space and did not fall inward to form the sun. Had Jupiter been several dozen times more massive, the matter in its interior would have undergone thermonuclear reactions, and Jupiter would have begun to shine by its own light. The largest planet is a star that failed. Even so, its interior temperatures are sufficiently high that it gives off about twice as much energy as it receives from the sun. In the infrared part of the spectrum, it might even be correct to consider Jupiter a star. Had it become a star in visible light, we would today inhabit a binary or double star system with two suns in our sky, and the nights would come more rarely, a commonplace, I believe, in countless solar systems throughout the Milky Way galaxy. We would doubtless think the circumstances natural and lovely. Deep below the clouds of Jupiter, the weight of the overlying layers of atmosphere produces pressures much higher than any found on Earth, pressures so great that electrons are squeezed off hydrogen atoms, producing a remarkable substance, liquid metallic hydrogen, a physical state that has never been achieved on Earth. There is some hope that metallic hydrogen is a superconductor at moderate temperatures. If it could be manufactured on Earth, it would work a revolution in electronics. In the interior of Jupiter, where the pressures are about 3 million times the atmospheric pressure at the surface of the Earth, there is almost nothing but a great dark sloshing ocean of metallic hydrogen. But at the very core of Jupiter, there may be a lump of rock and iron, an Earth-like world in a pressure vise hidden forever at the center of the largest planet. The electrical currents in the liquid metal interior of Jupiter may be the source of the planet's enormous magnetic field, the largest in the solar system, and of its associated belt of trapped electrons and protons. These charged particles are ejected from the sun in the solar wind and captured and accelerated by Jupiter's magnetic field. Vast numbers of them are trapped far above the clouds and are condemned to bounce from pole to pole, until by chance they encounter some high-altitude atmospheric molecule and are removed from the radiation belt. Io moves in an orbit so close to Jupiter that it plows through the midst of this intense radiation, creating cascades of charged particles which, in turn, generate violent bursts of radio energy. They may also influence eruptive processes on the surface of Io. It is possible to predict radio bursts from Jupiter with better reliability than weather forecasts on Earth by computing the position of Io. That Jupiter is a source of radio emission was discovered accidentally in the 1950s, the early days of radio astronomy. Two young Americans, Bernard Burke and Kenneth Franklin, were examining the sky with a newly constructed, and for that time, very sensitive, radio telescope. They were searching the cosmic radio background, that is, radio sources far beyond our solar system. To their surprise, they found an intense and previously unreported source that seemed to correspond to no prominent star, nebula, or galaxy. What is more, it gradually moved with respect to the distant stars, much faster than any remote object could. After finding no likely explanation of all this in their charts of the distant cosmos, they one day stepped outside the observatory and looked up at the sky with the naked eye to see if anything interesting happened to be there. Bemusedly, they noted an exceptionally bright object in the right place, which they soon identified as the planet Jupiter. This accidental discovery is, incidentally, entirely typical of the history of science. Every evening, before Voyager 1's encounter with Jupiter, I could see that giant planet twinkling in the sky, a sight our ancestors have enjoyed and wondered at for a million years. And on the evening of encounter, on my way to study the Voyager data arriving at JPL, I thought that Jupiter would never be the same, never again just a point of light in the night sky, but would forever after be a place to be explored and known. Jupiter and its moons are a kind of miniature solar system, an exquisite world with much to teach us. In composition, and in many other respects, Saturn is similar to Jupiter, although smaller. Rotating once every 10 hours, it exhibits colorful equatorial banding, which is, however, not so prominent as Jupiter's. It has a weaker magnetic field and radiation belt than Jupiter, and a more spectacular set of circumplanetary rings. And it is also surrounded by a dozen or more satellites. The most interesting of the moons of Saturn seems to be Titan, the largest moon in the solar system and the only one with a substantial atmosphere. Prior to the encounter of Voyager 1 with Titan in November 1980, our information about Titan was scanty and tantalizing. The only gas known unambiguously to be present was methane, CH4, discovered by G.P. Kuiper. Ultraviolet light from the sun converts methane to more complex hydrocarbon molecules and hydrogen gas. The hydrocarbons should remain on Titan, covering the surface with a brownish, tarry, organic sludge, something like that produced in experiments on the origin of life on Earth. The lightweight hydrogen gas should, because of Titan's low gravity, rapidly escape to space by a violent process known as blow-off, which should carry the methane and other atmospheric constituents with it. But Titan has an atmospheric pressure at least as great as that of the planet Mars. Blow-off does not seem to be happening. Perhaps there is some major and as yet undiscovered atmospheric constituent, nitrogen, for example, which keeps the average molecular weight of the atmosphere high and prevents blow-off. Or perhaps blow-off is happening, but the gases lost to space are being replenished by others released from the satellite's interior. The bulk density of Titan is so low that there must be a vast supply of water and other ices, probably including methane, which are at unknown rates being released to the surface by internal heating. When we examine Titan through the telescope, we see a barely perceptible reddish disk. Some observers have reported variable white clouds above that disk, most likely clouds of methane crystals. But what is responsible for the reddish coloration? Most students of Titan agree that complex organic molecules are the most likely explanation. The surface temperature and atmospheric thickness are still under debate. There have been some hints of an enhanced surface temperature due to an atmospheric greenhouse effect. With abundant organic molecules on its surface and in its atmosphere, Titan is a remarkable and unique denizen of the solar system. The history of our past voyages of discovery suggests that Voyager and other spacecraft reconnaissance missions will revolutionize our knowledge of this place. Through a break in the clouds of Titan, you might glimpse Saturn and its rings, their pale yellow color diffused by the intervening atmosphere. Because the Saturn system is 10 times farther from the sun than is the Earth, the sunshine on Titan is only 1% as intense as we are accustomed to, and the temperatures should be far below the freezing point of water, even with a sizable atmospheric greenhouse effect. But with abundant organic matter, sunlight, and perhaps volcanic hotspots, the possibility of life on Titan cannot be readily dismissed. In that very different environment, it would, of course, have to be very different from life on Earth. There is no strong evidence either for or against life on Titan. It is merely possible. We are unlikely to determine the answer to this question without landing instrumented space vehicles on the Titanian surface. To examine the individual particles composing the rings of Saturn, we must approach them closely, for the particles are small. snowballs, and ice chips, and tiny tumbling bonsai glaciers a meter or so across. We know they are composed of water ice because the spectral properties of sunlight reflected off the rings match those of ice in the laboratory measurements. To approach the particles in a space vehicle, we must slow down so that we move along with them as they circle Saturn at some 45,000 miles per hour. That is, we must be in orbit around Saturn ourselves, moving at the same speed as the particles. Only then will we be able to see them individually and not as smears or streaks. Why is there not a single large satellite instead of a ring system around Saturn? The closer a ring particle is to Saturn, the faster its orbital speed, the faster it is falling around the planet, Kepler's third law. The inner particles are streaming past the outer ones. The passing lane, as we see it, is always to the left. Although the whole assemblage is tearing around the planet itself at some 20 kilometers per second, the relative speed of two adjacent particles is very low, only some few centimeters per minute. Because of this relative motion, the particles can never stick together by their mutual gravity. As soon as they try, their slightly different orbital speeds pull them apart. If the ring were not so close to Saturn, this effect would not be so strong and the particles could accrete, making small snowballs and eventually growing into satellites. So it is probably no coincidence that outside the rings of Saturn, there is a system of satellites varying in size from a few hundred kilometers across to Titan, a giant moon nearly as large as the planet Mars. The matter in all the satellites and the planets themselves may have been originally distributed in the form of rings, which condensed and accumulated to form the present moons and planets. For Saturn, as for Jupiter, the magnetic field captures and accelerates the charged particles of the solar wind. When a charged particle bounces from one magnetic pole to the other, it must cross the equatorial plane of Saturn. If there is a ring particle in the way, the proton or electron is absorbed by this small snowball. As a result, for both planets, the rings clear out the radiation belts, which exist only interior and exterior to the particle rings. A close moon of Jupiter or Saturn will likewise gobble up radiation belt particles. And in fact, one of the new moons of Saturn was discovered in just this way. Pioneer 11 found an unexpected gap in the radiation belts caused by the sweeping up of charged particles by a previously unknown moon. The solar wind trickles into the outer solar system far beyond the orbit of Saturn. When Voyager reaches Uranus and the orbits of Neptune and Pluto, if the instruments are still functioning, they will almost certainly sense its presence, the wind between the worlds, the top of the sun's atmosphere blown outward toward the realm of the stars. Some two or three times farther from the sun than Pluto is, the pressure of the interstellar protons and electrons becomes greater than the minuscule pressure there exerted by the solar wind. That place, called the heliopause, is one definition of the outer boundary of the empire of the sun. But the Voyager spacecraft will plunge on, penetrating the heliopause sometime in the middle of the 21st century, skimming through the ocean of space, never to enter another solar system, destined to wander through eternity, far from the stellar islands, and to complete its first circumnavigation of the massive center of the Milky Way a few hundred million years from now. We have embarked on epic voyages. Chapter 7, The Backbone of Night. I would rather understand one cause than be king of Persia. Democritus of Abdera. If a faithful account was rendered of man's ideas upon divinity, he would be obliged to acknowledge that for the most part, the word gods has been used to express the concealed, remote, unknown causes of the effects he witnessed. That he applies this term when the spring of the natural, the source of known causes, ceases to be visible. As soon as he loses the thread of these causes, or as soon as his mind can no longer follow the chain, he solves the difficulty, terminates his research by ascribing it to his gods. When, therefore, he ascribes to his gods the production of some phenomenon, does he, in fact, do anything more than substitute for the darkness of his own mind a sound to which he has been accustomed to listen with reverential awe? Paul Heinrich Dietrich Baron von Holbach, System de la Nature, London, 1770. When I was little, I lived in the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn in the city of New York. I knew my immediate neighborhood intimately. Every apartment building, pigeon coop, backyard, front stoop, empty lot, elm tree, ornamental railing, coal chute, and wall for playing Chinese handball, among which the brick exterior of a theater called the Lowe's Stillwell was of superior quality. I knew where many people lived: Bruno and Dino, Ronald and Harvey, Sandy, Bernie, Danny, Jackie, and Myra. But more than a few blocks away, north of the raucous automobile traffic and elevated railway on 86th Street, was a strange, unknown territory, off limits to my wanderings. It could have been Mars, for all I knew. Even with an early bedtime, in winter you could sometimes see the stars. I would look at them, twinkling and remote, and wonder what they were. I would ask older children and adults, who would only reply, "They're lights in the sky, kid." I could see they were lights in the sky, but what were they? Just small hovering lamps? Whatever for? I felt a kind of sorrow for them, a commonplace whose strangeness remained somehow hidden from my incurious fellows. There had to be some deeper answer. As soon as I was old enough, my parents gave me my first library card. I think the library was on 85th Street, an alien land. Immediately, I asked the librarian for something on stars. She returned with a picture book displaying portraits of men and women with names like Clark Gable and Jean Harlow. I complained, and for some reason then obscure to me, she smiled and found another book, the right kind of book. I opened it breathlessly and read until I found it. The book said something astonishing. A very big thought. It said that the stars were suns, only very far away. The sun was a star, but close up. Imagine that you took the sun and moved it so far away that it was just a tiny twinkling point of light. How far away would you have to move it? I was innocent of the notion of angular size. I was ignorant of the inverse square law for light propagation. I had not a ghost of a chance of calculating the distance to the stars, but I could tell that if the stars were suns, they had to be very far away. Farther away than 85th Street, farther away than Manhattan, farther away probably than New Jersey. The cosmos was much bigger than I had guessed. Later, I read another astonishing fact. The Earth, which includes Brooklyn, is a planet and it goes around the sun. There are other planets. They also go around the sun. Some are closer to it, and some are farther away. But the planets do not shine by their own light as the sun does. They merely reflect light from the sun. If you were a great distance away, you would not see the Earth and the other planets at all. They would be only faint luminous points lost in the glare of the sun. Well then, I thought, it stood to reason that the other stars must have planets too. Ones we have not yet detected, and some of those other planets should have life. Why not? A kind of life probably different from life as we know it, life in Brooklyn. So I decided I would be an astronomer, learn about the stars and planets, and, if I could, go and visit them. It has been my immense good fortune to have parents and some teachers who encouraged this odd ambition, and to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds and engaging in a deep reconnaissance of the cosmos. If I had been born in a much earlier age, no matter how great my dedication, I would not have understood what the stars and planets are. I would not have known that there were other suns and other worlds. This is one of the great secrets wrested from nature through a million years of patient observation and courageous thinking by our ancestors. What are the stars? Such questions are as natural as an infant's smile. We have always asked them. What is different about our time is that at last we know some of the answers. Books and libraries provide a ready means for finding out what those answers are. In biology, there is a principle of powerful, if imperfect, applicability called recapitulation. In our individual embryonic development, we retrace the evolutionary history of the species. There is, I think, a kind of recapitulation that occurs in our individual intellectual developments as well. We unconsciously retrace the thoughts of our remote ancestors. Imagine a time before science, a time before libraries. Imagine a time hundreds of thousands of years ago. We were then just about as smart, just as curious, just as involved in things social and sexual. But the experiments had not yet been done. The inventions had not yet been made. It was the childhood of genus Homo. Imagine the time when fire was first discovered. What were human lives like then? What did our ancestors believe the stars were? Sometimes, in my fantasies, I imagine there was someone who thought like this. We eat berries and roots, nuts and leaves, and dead animals. Some animals we find, some we kill. We know which foods are good and which are dangerous. If we taste some foods, we are struck down in punishment for eating them. We did not mean to do something bad, but foxglove or hemlock can kill you. We love our children and our friends. We warn them of such foods. When we hunt animals, then also can we be killed. We can be gored or trampled or eaten. What animals do means life and death for us. How they behave, what tracks they leave, their times for mating and giving birth, their times for wandering. We must know these things. We tell our children. They will tell their children. We depend on animals. We follow them, especially in winter when there are few plants to eat. We are wandering hunters and gatherers. We call ourselves the hunter folk. Most of us fall asleep under the sky or under a tree or in its branches. We use animal skins for clothing to keep us warm, to cover our nakedness, and sometimes as a hammock. When we wear the animal skins, we feel the animal's power. We leap with the gazelle. We hunt with the bear. There is a bond between us and the animals. We hunt and eat the animals. They hunt and eat us. We are part of one another. We make tools and stay alive. Some of us are experts at splitting, flaking, sharpening, and polishing, as well as finding rocks. Some rocks we tie with animal sinew to a wooden handle and make an axe. With the axe, we strike plants and animals. Other rocks are tied to long sticks. If we are quiet and watchful, we can sometimes come close to an animal and stick it with the spear. Meat spoils. Sometimes we are hungry and try not to notice. Sometimes we mix herbs with the bad meat to hide the taste. We fold foods that will not spoil into pieces of animal skin, or big leaves, or the shell of a large nut. It is wise to put food aside and carry it. If we eat this food too early, some of us will starve later. So we must help one another. For this and many other reasons, we have rules. Everyone must obey the rules. We have always had rules. Rules are sacred. One day, there was a storm with much lightning and thunder and rain. The little ones are afraid of storms, and sometimes so am I. The secret of the storm is hidden. The thunder is deep and loud. The lightning is brief and bright. Maybe someone very powerful is very angry. It must be someone in the sky, I think. After the storm, there was a flickering and crackling in the forest nearby. We went to see. There was a bright, hot, leaping thing, yellow and red. We had never seen such a thing before. We now call it flame. It has a special smell. In a way, it is alive. It eats food. It eats plants and tree limbs and even whole trees, if you let it. It is strong, but it is not very smart. If all the food is gone, it dies. It will not walk a spear's throw from one tree to another if there is no food along the way. It cannot walk without eating. But where there is much food, it grows and makes many flame children. One of us had a brave and fearful thought to capture the flame, feed it a little, and make it our friend. We found some long branches of hard wood. The flame was eating them, but slowly. We could pick them up by the end that had no flame. If you run fast with a small flame, it dies. Their children are weak. We did not run. We walked, shouting good wishes. "Do not die," we said to the flame. The other hunter folk looked with wide eyes. Even after we have carried it with us, we have a flame mother to feed the flame slowly so it does not die of hunger. Flame is a wonder, and useful, too, surely a gift from powerful beings. Are they the same as the angry beings in the storm? The flame keeps us warm on cold nights. It gives us light. It makes holes in the darkness when the moon is new. We can fix spears at night for tomorrow's hunt, and if we are not tired, even in the darkness, we can see each other and talk. Also, a good thing, fire keeps animals away. We can be hurt at night. Sometimes we have been eaten, even by small animals, hyenas and wolves. Now it is different. Now the flame keeps the animals back. We see them baying softly in the dark, prowling, their eyes glowing in the light of the flame. They are frightened of the flame, but we are not frightened. The flame is ours. We take care of the flame. The flame takes care of us. The sky is important. It covers us. It speaks to us. Before the time we found the flame, we would lie back in the dark and look up at all the points of light. Some points would come together to make a picture in the sky. One of us could see the pictures better than the rest. She taught us the star pictures, and what names to call them. We would sit around late at night and make up stories about the pictures in the sky. Lions, dogs, bears, hunter folk, other stranger things. Could they be the pictures of the powerful beings in the sky, the ones who make the storms when angry? Mostly, the sky does not change. The same star pictures are there year after year. The moon grows from nothing to a thin sliver to a round ball and then back again to nothing. When the moon changes, the women bleed. Some tribes have rules against sex at certain times in the growing and shrinking of the moon. Some tribes scratch the days of the moon or the days that the women bleed on antler bones. Then they can plan ahead and obey their rules. Rules are sacred. The stars are very far away. When we climb a hill or a tree, they are no closer. And clouds come between us and the stars. The stars must be behind the clouds. The moon, as it slowly moves, passes in front of stars. Later, you can see that the stars are not harmed. The moon does not eat stars. The stars must be behind the moon. They flicker, a strange, cold, white faraway light, many of them, all over the sky, but only at night. I wonder what they are. After we found the flame, I was sitting near the campfire wondering about the stars. Slowly, a thought came. The stars are flame, I thought. Then I had another thought. The stars are campfires that other hunter folk light at night. The stars give a smaller light than campfires, so the stars must be campfires very far away. But, they ask me, how can there be campfires in the sky? Why do the campfires and the hunter people around those flames not fall down at our feet? Why don't strange tribes drop from the sky? Those are good questions. They trouble me. Sometimes I think the sky is half of a big eggshell or big nutshell. I think the people around those faraway campfires look down at us, except for them it seems up, and say that we are in their sky and wonder why we do not fall up to them, if you see what I mean. But hunter folk say down is down and up is up. That is a good answer, too. There is another thought that one of us had. His thought is that night is a great black animal skin thrown up over the sky. There are holes in the skin. We look through the holes and we see flame. His thought is not just that there is flame in a few places where we see stars. He thinks there is flame everywhere. He thinks flame covers the whole sky, but the skin hides the flame, except where there are holes. Some stars wander, like the animals we hunt, like us. If you watch with care over many months, you find they move. There are only 5 of them, like the fingers on a hand. They wander slowly among the stars. If the campfire thought is true, those stars must be tribes of wandering hunter folk carrying big fires. But I don't see how wandering stars can be holes in a skin. When you make a hole, there it is. A hole is a hole. Holes do not wander. Also, I don't want to be surrounded by a sky of flame. If the skin fell, the night sky would be bright, too bright, like seeing flame everywhere. I think a sky of flame would eat us all. Maybe there are 2 kinds of powerful beings in the sky, bad ones who wish the flame to eat us, and good ones who put up the skin to keep the flame away. We must find some way to thank the good ones. I don't know if the stars are campfires in the sky, or holes in a skin through which the flame of power looks down on us. Sometimes I think one way, sometimes I think a different way. Once, I thought there are no campfires and no holes, but something else too hard for me to understand. Rest your neck on a log, your head goes back, then you can see only the sky. No hills, no trees, no hunter folk, no campfire, just sky. Sometimes I feel I may fall up into the sky. If the stars are campfires, I would like to visit those other hunter folk, the ones who wander. Then I feel good about falling up. But if the stars are holes in a skin, I become afraid. I don't want to fall up through a hole and into the flame of power. I wish I knew which was true. I don't like not knowing. I do not imagine that many members of a hunter-gatherer group had thoughts like these about the stars. Perhaps over the ages, a few did, but never all these thoughts in the same person. Yet, sophisticated ideas are common in such communities. For example, the Kung Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert in Botswana have an explanation for the Milky Way, which at their latitude, is often overhead. They call it the backbone of night, as if the sky were some great beast inside which we live. Their explanation makes the Milky Way useful as well as understandable. The Kung believe the Milky Way holds up the night, that if it were not for the Milky Way, fragments of darkness would come crashing down at our feet. It is an elegant idea. Metaphors, like those about celestial campfires or galactic backbones, were eventually replaced in most human cultures by another idea. The powerful beings in the sky were promoted to gods. They were given names and relatives and special responsibilities for the cosmic services they were expected to perform. There was a god or goddess for every human concern. Gods ran nature. Nothing could happen without their direct intervention. If they were happy, there was plenty of food, and humans were happy. But if something displeased the gods, and sometimes it took very little, the consequences were awesome. Droughts, storms, wars, earthquakes, volcanoes, epidemics. The gods had to be propitiated, and a vast industry of priests and oracles arose to make the gods less angry. But because the gods were capricious, you could not be sure what they would do. Nature was a mystery. It was hard to understand the world. Little remains of the Hurrian on the Aegean Isle of Samos, one of the wonders of the ancient world, a great temple dedicated to Hera, who began her career as goddess of the sky. She was the patron deity of Samos, playing the same role there as Athena did in Athens. Much later, she married Zeus, the chief of the Olympian gods. They honeymooned on Samos, the old stories tell us. The Greek religion explained that diffuse band of light in the night sky as the milk of Hera, squirted from her breast across the heavens, a legend that is the origin of the phrase Westerners still use, the Milky Way. Perhaps it originally represented the important insight that the sky nurtures the earth. If so, that meaning seems to have been forgotten millennia ago. We are, almost all of us, descended from people who responded to the dangers of existence by inventing stories about unpredictable or disgruntled deities. For a long time, the human instinct to understand was thwarted by facile religious explanations, as in ancient Greece in the time of Homer, where there were gods of the sky and the earth, the thunderstorm, the oceans and the underworld, fire and time and love and war, where every tree and meadow had its dryad and maenad. For thousands of years, humans were oppressed, as some of us still are, by the notion that the universe is a marionette whose strings are pulled by a god or gods, unseen and inscrutable. Then, 2,500 years ago, there was a glorious awakening in Ionia, on Samos, and the other nearby Greek colonies that grew up among the islands and inlets of the busy eastern Aegean Sea. Suddenly, there were people who believed that everything was made of atoms, that human beings and other animals had sprung from simpler forms, that diseases were not caused by demons or the gods, that the Earth was only a planet going around the sun, and that the stars were very far away. This revolution made cosmos out of chaos. The early Greeks had believed that the first being was chaos, corresponding to the phrase in Genesis in the same context, without form. Chaos created and then mated with a goddess called Night, and their offspring eventually produced all the gods and men. A universe created from chaos was in perfect keeping with the Greek belief in an unpredictable nature run by capricious gods. But in the 6th century BC in Ionia, a new concept developed, one of the great ideas of the human species. The universe is knowable, the ancient Ionians argued, because it exhibits an internal order. There are regularities in nature that permit its secrets to be uncovered. Nature is not entirely unpredictable. There are rules even she must obey. This ordered and admirable character of the universe was called cosmos. But why Ionia? Why in these unassuming and pastoral landscapes, these remote islands and inlets of the eastern Mediterranean? Why not in the great cities of India or Egypt, Babylonia, China, or Mesoamerica? China had an astronomical tradition millennia old. It invented paper and printing, rockets, clocks, silk, porcelain, and ocean-going navies. Some historians argue it was nevertheless too traditionalist a society, too unwilling to adopt innovations. Why not India, an extremely rich, mathematically gifted culture? Because some historians maintain of a rigid fascination with the idea of an infinitely old universe condemned to an endless cycle of deaths and rebirths, of souls and universes in which nothing fundamentally new could ever happen. Why not Mayan and Aztec societies, which were accomplished in astronomy and captivated, as the Indians were, by large numbers? Because some historians declare they lacked the aptitude or impetus for mechanical invention. The Mayans and the Aztecs did not even, except for children's toys, invent the wheel. The Ionians had several advantages. Ionia is an island realm. Isolation, even if incomplete, breeds diversity. With many different islands, there was a variety of political systems. No single concentration of power could enforce social and intellectual conformity in all the islands. Free inquiry became possible. The promotion of superstition was not considered a political necessity. Unlike many other cultures, the Ionians were at the crossroads of civilizations, not at one of the centers. In Ionia, the Phoenician alphabet was first adapted to Greek usage, and widespread literacy became possible. Writing was no longer a monopoly of the priests and scribes. The thoughts of many were available for consideration and debate. Political power was in the hands of the merchants who actively promoted the technology on which their prosperity depended. It was in the Eastern Mediterranean that African, Asian, and European civilizations, including the great cultures of Egypt and Mesopotamia, met and cross-fertilized in a vigorous and heady confrontation of prejudices, languages, ideas, and gods. What do you do when you are faced with several different gods, each claiming the same territory? The Babylonian Marduk and the Greek Zeus was each considered master of the sky and king of the gods. You might decide that Marduk and Zeus were really the same. You might also decide, since they had quite different attributes, that one of them was merely invented by the priests. But if one, why not both? And so it was that the great idea arose. The realization that there might be a way to know the world without the God hypothesis, that there might be principles, forces, laws of nature through which the world could be understood without attributing the fall of every sparrow to the direct intervention of Zeus. China and India and Mesoamerica would, I think, have tumbled to science too if only they had been given a little more time. Cultures do not develop with identical rhythms or evolve in lockstep. They arise at different times and progress at different rates. The scientific worldview works so well, explains so much, and resonates so harmoniously with the most advanced parts of our brains that in time, I think, virtually every culture on the earth, left to its own devices, would have discovered science. Some culture had to be first. As it turned out, Ionia was the place where science was born. Between 600 and 400 BC, this great revolution in human thought began. The key to the revolution was the hand. Some of the brilliant Ionian thinkers were the sons of sailors and farmers and weavers. They were accustomed to poking and fixing, unlike the priests and scribes of other nations who, raised in luxury, were reluctant to dirty their hands. They rejected superstition, and they worked wonders. In many cases, we have only fragmentary or second-hand accounts of what happened. The metaphors used then may be obscure to us now. There was almost certainly a conscious effort a few centuries later to suppress the new insights. The leading figures in this revolution were men with Greek names, largely unfamiliar to us today, but the truest pioneers in the development of our civilization and our humanity. The first Ionian scientist was Thales of Miletus, a city in Asia across a narrow channel of water from the island of Samos. He had traveled in Egypt and was conversant with the knowledge of Babylon. It is said that he predicted a solar eclipse. He learned how to measure the height of a pyramid from the length of its shadow and the angle of the sun above the horizon, a method employed today to determine the heights of the mountains of the moon. He was the first to prove geometric theorems of the sort codified by Euclid 3 centuries later. For example, the proposition that the angles at the base of an isosceles triangle are equal. There is a clear continuity of intellectual effort from Thales to Euclid to Isaac Newton's purchase of the Elements of Geometry at Stourbridge Fair in 1663, the event that precipitated modern science and technology. Thales attempted to understand the world without invoking the intervention of the gods. Like the Babylonians, he believed the world to have once been water. To explain the dry land, the Babylonians added that Marduk had placed a mat on the face of the waters and piled dirt upon it. Thales held a similar view, but, as Benjamin Farrington said, left Marduk out. Yes, everything was once water, but the earth formed out of the oceans by a natural process, similar, he thought, to the silting he had observed at the delta of the Nile. Indeed, he thought that water was a common principle underlying all of matter, just as today we might say the same of electrons, protons, and neutrons, or of quarks. Whether Thales' conclusion was correct is not as important as his approach. The world was not made by gods, but instead was the work of material forces interacting in nature. Thales brought back from Babylon and Egypt the seeds of the new sciences of astronomy and geometry, sciences that would sprout and grow in the fertile soil of Ionia. Very little is known about the personal life of Thales, but one revealing anecdote is told by Aristotle in his Politics. Thales was reproached for his poverty, which was supposed to show that philosophy is of no use. According to the story, he knew by his skill in interpreting the heavens, while it was yet winter, that there would be a great harvest of olives in the coming year. So, having a little money, he gave deposits for the use of all the olive presses in Chios and Miletus, which he hired at a low price because no one bid against him. When the harvest time came, and many were wanted all at once, he let them out at any rate which he pleased, and made a quantity of money. Thus, he showed the world philosophers can easily be rich if they like, but that their ambition is of another sort. He was also famous as a political sage, successfully urging the Milesians to resist assimilation by Croesus, king of Lydia, and unsuccessfully urging a federation of all the island states of Ionia to oppose the Lydians. Anaximander of Miletus was a friend and colleague of Thales, one of the first people we know of to do an experiment. By examining the moving shadow cast by a vertical stick, he determined accurately the length of the year and the seasons. For ages, men had used sticks to club and spear one another. Anaximander used one to measure time. He was the first person in Greece to make a sundial, a map of the known world, and a celestial globe that showed the patterns of the constellations. He believed the sun, the moon, and the stars to be made of fire seen through moving holes in the dome of the sky, probably a much older idea. He held the remarkable view that the earth is not suspended or supported from the heavens, but that it remains by itself at the center of the universe. Since it was equidistant from all places on the celestial sphere, there was no force that could move it. He argued that we are so helpless at birth that if the first human infants had been put into the world on their own, they would immediately have died. From this, Anaximander concluded that human beings arose from other animals with more self-reliant newborns. He proposed the spontaneous origin of life in mud, the first animals being fish covered with spines. Some descendants of these fishes eventually abandoned the water and moved to dry land, where they evolved into other animals by the transmutation of one form into another. He believed in an infinite number of worlds, all inhabited and all subject to cycles of dissolution and regeneration. Nor, As St. Augustine ruefully complained, did he, any more than Thales, attribute the cause of all this ceaseless activity to a divine mind? In the year 540 BC, or thereabouts, on the island of Samos, there came to power a tyrant named Polycrates. He seems to have started as a caterer and then gone on to international piracy. Polycrates was a generous patron of the arts, sciences, and engineering, but he oppressed his own people. He made war on his neighbors. He quite rightly feared invasion. So he surrounded his capital city with a massive wall about 6 kilometers long, whose remains stand to this day. To carry water from a distant spring through the fortifications, he ordered a great tunnel built. 1 kilometer long, it pierces a mountain. 2 cuttings were dug from either end, which met almost perfectly in the middle. The project took about 15 years to complete, a testament to the civil engineering of the day and an indication of the extraordinary practical capability of the Ionians. But there is another and more ominous side to the enterprise. It was built in part by slaves in chains, many captured by the pirate ships of Polycrates. This was the time of Theodorus, the master engineer of the age, credited among the Greeks with the invention of the key, the ruler, the carpenter's square, the level, the lathe, bronze casting, and central heating. Why are there no monuments to this man? Those who dreamed and speculated about the laws of nature talked with the technologists and the engineers. They were often the same people. The theoretical and the practical were one. About the same time, on the nearby island of Kos, Hippocrates was establishing his famous medical tradition, now barely remembered because of the Hippocratic Oath. It was a practical and effective school of medicine which Hippocrates insisted had to be based on the contemporary equivalent of physics and chemistry. But it also had its theoretical side. In his book, On Ancient Medicine, Hippocrates wrote, "Men think epilepsy divine, merely because they do not understand it. But if they called everything divine, which they do not understand, why, there would be no end of divine things." In time, the Ionian influence and the experimental method spread to the mainland of Greece, to Italy, to Sicily. There was once a time when hardly anyone believed in air. They knew about breathing, of course, and they thought the wind was the breath of the gods, but the idea of air as a static, material, but invisible substance was unimagined. The first recorded experiment on air was performed by a physician named Empedocles, who flourished around 450 BC. Some accounts claimed he identified himself as a god, but perhaps it was only that he was so clever that others thought him a god. He believed that light travels very fast, but not infinitely fast. He taught that there was once a much greater variety of living things on the earth, but that many races of beings must have been unable to beget and continue their kind. For in the case of every species that exists, either craft or courage or speed has from the beginning of its existence protected and preserved it. In this attempt to explain the lovely adaptation of organisms to their environments, Empedocles, like Anaximander and Democritus, clearly anticipated some aspects of Darwin's great idea of evolution by natural selection. Empedocles performed his experiment with a household implement people had used for centuries, the so-called clepsydra, or water thief, which was used as a kitchen ladle. A brazen sphere with an open neck and small holes in the bottom, it is filled by immersing it in water. If you pull it out with the neck uncovered, the water pours out of the holes, making a little shower. But if you pull it out properly, with your thumb covering the neck, the water is retained within the sphere until you lift your thumb. If you try to fill it with the neck covered, nothing happens. Some material substance must be in the way of the water. We cannot see such a substance. What could it be? Empedocles argued that it could only be air. A thing we cannot see can exert pressure, can frustrate my wish to fill a vessel with water if I were dumb enough to leave my finger on the neck. Empedocles had discovered the invisible. Air, he thought, must be matter in a form so finely divided that it could not be seen. Empedocles is said to have died in an apotheotic fit by leaping into the hot lava at the summit caldera of the great volcano of Etna. But I sometimes imagine that he merely slipped during a courageous and pioneering venture in observational geophysics. This hint, this whiff of the existence of atoms, was carried much further by a man named Democritus, who came from the Ionian colony of Abdera in northern Greece. Abdera was a kind of joke town. If, in 430 BC, you told a story about someone from Abdera, you were guaranteed a laugh. It was, in a way, the Brooklyn of its time. For Democritus, all of life was to be enjoyed and understood. Understanding and enjoyment were the same thing. He said that a life without festivity is a long road without an end. Democritus may have come from Abdera, but he was no dummy. He believed that a large number of worlds had formed spontaneously out of diffuse matter in space, evolved, and then decayed. At a time when no one knew about impact craters, Democritus thought that worlds on occasion collide. He believed that some worlds wandered alone through the darkness of space, while others were accompanied by several suns and moons, that some worlds were inhabited while others had no plants or animals or even water, that the simplest forms of life arose from a kind of primeval ooze. He taught that perception, the reason, say, I think there is a pen in my hand, was a purely physical and mechanistic process, that thinking and feeling were attributes of matter put together in a sufficiently fine and complex way and not due to some spirit infused into matter by the gods. Democritus invented the word atom, Greek for unable to be cut. Atoms were the ultimate particles, forever frustrating our attempts to break them into smaller pieces. Everything, he said, is a collection of atoms, intricately assembled. Even we. Nothing exists, he said, but atoms and the void. When we cut an apple, the knife must pass through empty spaces between the atoms, Democritus argued. If there were no such empty spaces, no void, the knife would encounter the impenetrable atoms and the apple could not be cut. Having cut a slice from a cone, say, let us compare the cross sections of the two pieces. Are the exposed areas equal? No, said Democritus. The slope of the cone forces one side of the slice to have a slightly smaller cross-section than the other. If the two areas were exactly equal, we would have a cylinder, not a cone. No matter how sharp the knife, the two pieces have unequal cross-sections. Why? Because, on the scale of the very small, matter exhibits some irreducible roughness. This fine scale of roughness Democritus identified with the world of the atoms. His arguments were not those we use today, but they were subtle and elegant, derived from everyday life. And his conclusions were fundamentally correct. In a related exercise, Democritus imagined calculating the volume of a cone or a pyramid by a very large number of extremely small stacked plates tapering in size from the base to the apex. He had stated the problem that, in mathematics, is called the theory of limits. He was knocking at the door of the differential and integral calculus, that fundamental tool for understanding the world that was not, so far as we know from written records, in fact discovered until the time of Isaac Newton. Perhaps if Democritus's work had not been almost completely destroyed, there would have been calculus by the time of Christ. The frontiers of the calculus were also later breached by Eudoxus and Archimedes. Thomas Wright marveled in 1750 that Democritus had believed the Milky Way to be composed mainly of unresolved stars. Long before astronomy reaped any benefit from the improved science of optics, he saw, as we may say, through the eye of reason, full as far into infinity as the most able astronomers in more advantageous times have done since. Beyond the milk of Hera, past the backbone of night, the mind of Democritus soared. As a person, Democritus seems to have been somewhat unusual. Women, children, and sex discomfited him, in part because they took time away from thinking, but he valued friendship, held cheerfulness to be the goal of life, and devoted a major philosophical inquiry to the origin and nature of enthusiasm. He journeyed to Athens to visit Socrates and then found himself too shy to introduce himself. He was a close friend of Hippocrates. He was awed by the beauty and elegance of the physical world. He felt that poverty in a democracy was preferable to wealth in a tyranny. He believed that the prevailing religions of his time were evil, and that neither immortal souls nor immortal gods exist. Nothing exists but atoms and the void. There is no record of Democritus having been persecuted for his opinions, but then he came from Abdera. However, in his time, the brief tradition of tolerance for unconventional views began to erode and then to shatter. People came to be punished for having unusual ideas. A portrait of Democritus is now on the Greek 100-drachma bill. But his insights were suppressed. His influence on history made minor. The mystics were beginning to win. Anaxagoras was an Ionian experimentalist who flourished around 450 BC and lived in Athens. He was a rich man, indifferent to his wealth, but passionate about science. Asked what was the purpose of life, he replied, "The investigation of the sun, the moon, and the heavens." The reply of a true astronomer. He performed a clever experiment in which a single drop of white liquid, like cream, was shown not to lighten perceptibly the contents of a great pitcher of dark liquid, like wine. There must, he concluded, be changes deducible by experiment that are too subtle to be perceived directly by the senses. Anaxagoras was not nearly so radical as Democritus. Both were thoroughgoing materialists, not in prizing possessions, but in holding that matter alone provided the underpinnings of the world. Anaxagoras believed in a special mind substance and disbelieved in the existence of atoms. He thought humans were more intelligent than other animals because of our hands, a very Ionian idea.